for the reading for this month's sharing the Dharma was Anger and Other Disturbing Attitudes, chapter 4 through 8. And it's so much a part of sharing today with you, not only the chapters, but my understanding, to the extent that I can do that, is that in my journey on the spiritual path, which has taken, you know, years and years and years, is that I continually went searching to try to find something that would help me understand why I continually experienced suffering and why I was always so dissatisfied with life. And I went shopping all over the place. And there would be points, once I found the spiritual path, that I would be ecstatic, exhilarated. I'd read everything that I could. But then when these really, really afflictive emotions, these reactions would happen in my life, a lot of these paths that I was investigating, they never gave me any particular tools on how to deal with them. They never gave me a very specific, very, very clear definition of what it was I was dealing with in the first place. And second of all, on where the unhappiness was coming from, who was in charge of my feelings, and how best to remedy those emotions and those ways of thinking that caused me so much discontent. So until I met the Dharma, I really felt I felt continually discouraged. I wasn't sure whether I would ever be able to find a spiritual path that would really help me figure out why, as I got older, it seemed like I was getting more and more unhappy, that the suffering seemed to be coming in larger and larger ways and more frequently. And so one of the beauties about this book is that Venerable really takes those disturbing emotions and afflictions that we all experience, and some of us have our favorites that continually revisit, you know, our lives in any given day, and that she really explains the way in which the Buddha defined them as mental states, the causes for them, you know, what situations do some of these mental states seem to find their way up into. Once we're in them, what they really, really feel like, and where the source of them is from, the disadvantages, the source of the suffering, the discontent. And the best part is that the Buddha gave us specific antidotes and ways to deal with them, rather than, here I am, I'm full-blown angry. Do I ride it out? Do I throw it at somebody? You know, there was never like an antidote somehow to remedy a lot of the disturbing emotions that I felt in my life. So this book is really wonderful because it very much explains and defines the mental affliction as well as the virtuous states of mind and the causes, and then also how to remedy them. And so for this week, we've got anger, we've got closed-mindedness, pride, and jealousy. And then a little chapter 8, is really how to deal at the end of the day with the experiences that we've had at that day, and really how to take an inventory and how to review our lives in a particular way. So last month, Venerable spent the time talking about attachment, which I love the Buddhist definitions of some of these mental factors because they just make so much sense. So attachment is the exaggeration of positive qualities of people, of objects, of places and experiences. So we've got this particular, that rose-colored glasses sort of look, where we're exaggerating the positive qualities of anything that we see in front of us. We believe that it is the cause of our happiness, and that we get this sort of wanting, clinging, and grasping because the feel-good flavor, when we first come up with this experience of attachment, we want more of it. We don't want it to end. We don't want it to change. Give me more. I like this. So what inevitably happens, because we have invested all of our happiness on something outside ourselves, because the whole phenomenal world is impermanent, it's going to change, that thing starts to do something that we don't like. It starts behaving differently. It breaks down. It goes away. It starts to smell. It starts to criticize. It starts leaving its dirty clothes on the floor. And suddenly, that happiness is gone. And the dancing partner of happiness is anger, which its definition is the exaggeration of the negative qualities that we project onto a person, an object, or situation. Or we superimpose negative qualities that aren't even there. So we've got attachment dancing around the happiness that's on the outside, that, you know, everything outside brings us happiness. When that starts to change in shape, destabilize, the other part is that, of course, we're going to believe that the anger is also coming from the outside. So these are kind of dancing partners. And the more the attachment, the greater the attachment to a person, an experience, reputation, our opinions, when it goes awry, the bigger the anger response is, because we're still looking outside. Everything outside causes how we feel. So anger has got, I mean, this is something really has been one of the most eye-opening things for me, is because I wasn't a full-blown throw things, yell, scream, stamp my feet type of person, that I didn't think I had anger issues. And then when I had first met the Dharma, not only did I get this thing about it being the exaggeration of negative qualities, but it also includes hostility, resentment, irritation, belligerence, obnoxiousness, judgmental. These are all generic terms for anger, of which, I mean, I've had stewed in most of those feelings most of my life on the inside, but I didn't think I was an angry person. So anger covers a huge range of mental factors that aren't just the full-blown eruptive kind, but that kind of stewing, the resentful, the judgment, the bias, the prejudice, the hostility. So it really opens up a gamut. And then you just kind of, I mean, I don't know too many human beings, if not sentient beings, that don't have some sort of something of those, one part of them. What ends up happening with anger is that because we really perceive that the harm that's being done to us outside there is causing the anger, is that we walk around with somewhat of a victim mentality most of our life. You know, everything is externally caused. If it would just stop, if it would just change, if they would just do things differently, I wouldn't be angry. And so this really sets us up for having absolutely nothing to say about our feelings. So when anger arises, it's immediately somebody's fault. You know, or something broke, or something changed, or you don't like somebody's ideas. It's all externally generated so that anger arises due to something else outside of ourselves. And for me, why I could never really deal with my emotions, because I always thought that it was outside myself. And therefore I had no control over it, which was even more frustrating, because here I was with these emotions, but I had no control because I thought it was out there. The other kind of, the other piece that happens with anger and with all of the afflictive emotions is that the way that we're perceiving the situation and the person, we really believe that that perception is accurate, without any bias, without any subjectivity at all, and that is the way things are, which sometimes really almost it concretizes the anger even more, because we really believe that the way that we're seeing it is absolutely true. The other time when anger arises is when we receive some sort of suffering. I know that when I get sick, like when I get the flu or I have a really, really bad headache, I really have to watch my mind that I don't start getting upset and angry at the sickness itself, because it seems once again to be coming out of my control, that I have the anger arises due to that specifically, and that I'm really, really upset and angry at the sickness itself. Somehow, even though it's inside my body, I still kind of externalize it, that it's something that is causing the anger in my mind. So these are some of the ways in which anger arises. It's either towards a person, an object, a situation, physical suffering, criticism. But it's all around this exaggeration of qualities, the negative qualities of a situation. So we're not looking at the whole picture really, really accurately. We're only seeing a very, very small slice. And even that small slice is not accurate. Now, what happens is that, okay, so we're sitting in this place of anger or hostility or resentment. And you can kind of, you know, you can think to yourself, what does the flavor of your mind feel like? You know, what are the disadvantages of sitting in this space where you're upset, where I'm upset? or I'm resentful, or I'm feeling a lot of judgment. First of all, is that my mind is just, it's unhappy. I'm just miserable. You know, no matter who tries to be kind to me, I will see it as harm. I just sort of stew in this kind of miserable state of mind. From the Dharma viewpoint, the positive potential that we have created doing virtuous activity with any moments of anger, it basically destroys that. So all of this, you know, good intentions, good motivation, unless you protected it in some way by dedicating it and holding it in a safe place, moments of anger can destroy any type of positive potential or merit that was accumulated over quite a long period of time if we haven't protected it through dedication. I know that I have ruined a lot of friendships. I've isolated myself from a lot of support when I'm angry. I really, really feel alone. So anger itself really endangers the relationships. Usually the relationships that we treasure the most are the ones that anger really endangers the most frequently. When we're angry, we tend to not think very rationally. We behave usually outrageously. We don't have any, like we lose our common sense. We just spew, we just unload, we just, whatever comes out of our mouth. And later on, we just can't believe that we said what we said. So our common sense, our judgment, our respect and consideration for others really gets lost when our minds are filled with any type of resentment, hostility, or anger. And unfortunately, what happens is that we then create a pattern in our minds that for that to happen in future lives. So much about how we create karma is a propensity, a habituation. So if there are certain situations where we react in an angry sort of way, we are creating the propensity or the habituation to have that happen the next time it goes around. It might be not with the same person or the situation, but it'll come back around, and that habituation's already been in our mind stream. And it'll arise. The tendency for it to arise is very, very good. And probably the most dangerous thing about any type of afflictive emotions, but particularly about anger, is that it really impedes our ability to have realizations, to deepen our understanding of the Dharma, to cultivate any type of positive qualities. It becomes a major obstacle to our practice. Because the flavor of the mind that's angry has no room for kindness, has no room for wisdom or generosity or forgiveness. And so it becomes a huge roadblock in any type of effort that we have to deepen our understanding of the goodness of all things and of our positive potential. So the beauty about dealing with afflictive emotions, and particularly with anger, is that there's a lot of antidotes. And that's the thing I love about the Dharma, is that the Buddha gives us really practical antidotes on how to deal with anger. And some of these I've learned to use a lot more, particularly since I've been here at the Abbey. The first thing is that, and what Venerable writes in the book, is to enlarge our perspective. You know, think about, just be in the other person's shoes for a moment. Here's somebody who has just walked into your office and is just already picking faults, finding, criticizing you, giving you some really harsh feedback. It's just coming at you and you're not quite sure why. You're starting to get upset. You want to defend yourself. You want to come back and tell them something that might hurt their feelings. If you take a moment and just think about, perhaps there's something in their life that's going on. And I've seen this arise probably more than I ever thought before, is that, including myself, is that when I'm short-tempered and curt with other people, there's other things going on in my life that are sort of fueling that feeling in my mind. So people may be having health problems. They may be having difficulty at home. They may be having some crisis of personal life. And that's sort of riding inside their mind. And you just happen to walk into the room. And at that time, there's just too many pieces. And there's just a needing to unload. And you happen to be walking by. It's not even personal. And I've not only seen this happen from my side towards another person, I've also experienced it. So enlarging our perspective, especially when someone appears to be doing us harm, is to think, what perhaps could be going on in their life that could cause this? we know for a fact that they're just wanting to be happy and not suffer, and at this moment they're kind of using a rather confused way of doing that. And that instead of bringing anger into our minds, they should be objects of compassion for us, because we know what it's like to feel miserable. We know what it's like to be upset. There's not a lot of room to bring people into our lives, to really welcome support, to welcome the love and the care that we want. When we're angry and upset, we isolate. And so this person's trying to be happy and not suffer, but they're going about it in a really, really kind of strange way, similar to ways that we may do. And so they become objects of compassion rather than objects of our anger, our hostility, our belligerence, or our defensiveness. If it's a mistake that we made, it's like somebody, and this is a great analogy, it's like somebody looking at you going, Savannah, you have a nose on your face. they've pointed out a fault, they've pointed out a shortcoming, or giving us some feedback that would help us, and they're basically calling the nose on our face. Why is it that we get angry when somebody's pointing out there's a nose on our face? On the opposite side, if somebody's accusing us of something unjustly, and we know for a fact that that's true, that's just like saying, Carl, you've got three horns on the top of your head. You know, why be angry when somebody's accusing us unjustly of something that we know for a fact is not true? So it's like them saying that we have horns on our head. I mean, it takes a while to really warm up to this analogy, but it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. If you really sit with the whole idea about nose and horns and truth and not truth. And also being very, very clear about what you know to be true in your own heart, and to not be swayed by other people's feelings coming at you, positive or negative. The other part is the whole law of cause and effect. That if we perceive harm coming our way, and somebody's being really, really upset with us, chances are, in fact, the fact is, the truth is, that we have created the causes in the past to experience that at that moment. Whether it was unkindness or hostility or harsh words and speech at somebody else in the past, it didn't have to be the person who's right now giving you a hard time, is to really start using and understanding karma, that there's nothing that we experience in our lives that comes out of nowhere. It's not an accident. It's not, you know, chaos of the universe. That it is a result that we experience similar to the cause that we created. And so we put that in context. It becomes our responsibility. If we don't like the experiences that we're having in our lives, then we have to start creating the cause and conditions to have things differently. And what happens with that is that we then start really taking ownership of our own feelings. And we start kind of let people off the hook as far as causing the feelings. Now, I know that I've got a lot of buttons on me, and I have particular people in my life, particular personality types that just poke at them. They do it unwittingly. They do it unintentionally. It's not to say that there aren't people in our lives and situations that provoke the angry response, but they're not the cause of it itself. It's the button that's sitting in the middle of my heart that says, you know, too much feedback, giving you some ideas all the time, pushes that button that feels like it wants to defend itself and justify. So I need to pay attention to the button to see if I can make that smaller, rather than to tell the people to shut their mouths and go away. Mm-hmm. Which is also temptation. And then the other one, as far as anger, is in context of like the bigger world picture, the injustice, the global warming, the greed, the corruption, is that we've got to be able to understand that, first of all, change. Things are constantly changing. That we can promote change by using a lot of patience and a lot of clarity. Things are not going to change in a very, very short time. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of effort. Once again, as individuals and as a community of human beings, we've got to start creating the causes and conditions to experience different results than we're experiencing right now. But it's a long-term aspiration. It's not something that is going to happen in the next moment. And also to realize that those corporations, the governments, those that appear to be doing extraordinary harm are also wanting to be happy and not suffer, and using some very bizarre, wild techniques to try to achieve that for themselves, for their people, for their corporations, for their best friends, for their political, philosophical views. They're really wanting to be happy. If you really put the world's situation right now is the entire human family is trying to be happy in some very, very bizarre ways. We all become objects of compassion for each other rather than objects of hatred and wanting to harm and retaliate. So patience is the most powerful antidote to anger. And that doesn't mean being a doormat. It doesn't mean rolling over and say, whatever, fine. Patience is a particular mental factor that is very, very calm, very, very clear, understands clearly how to move, can be very, very firm, can be very, very direct, can even be wrathful, but there's no anger involved whatsoever. But it's the mind being very, very clear and calm at that moment. It's not agitated. It doesn't have an outcome attached to its behavior. It's really, really seeing clearly what needs to be done and being very, very direct on how to achieve that. And also patience gives us more of a long term. You know, it's once again, it's this whole idea that things don't change very, very quickly. Patience lets go of a lot of short-sightedness. It also relieves us of a lot of expectations that we have about ourselves and about others. And it generates a lot of positive potential, and it also generates a lot of causes and conditions to alleviate these angry seeds in our mind. Patience is a powerful antidote. It's like putting a healing salve on a very, very wounded part of our mind. And so to really use that as a very fundamental antidote for anger. So going from anger, the second one of the afflictive emotions that are in the study this month is closed-mindedness, which in my mind it has a little bit of irritation and agitation in it too. It's a way of thinking that says pretty much I've got it all figured out. I don't need your advice. I don't need any new ideas. I don't need any new suggestions. It's the basis of a lot of prejudices in our world. You know, the part of when our minds are closed-minded, people that are different are scary. People that are different make us fearful. Ideas and philosophies and ways of thinking that are different. When we're closed-minded, there's a fear. There's a little bit of a paranoia that's involved with closed-mindedness. And, you know, when I think sometimes, because as I get older, I have to be more and more careful of this because I assume that as I get older, I get wiser. But what happens is that I have to keep an eye because sometimes closed-mindedness steps in instead of wisdom that says, you know, you haven't been around as long as me, you're a lot younger than me, you've not done this, you've not done that, therefore you don't know anything. And I have to be really, really vigilant around it because I feel that my age somehow gives me an entitlement to be a little bit closed-minded and righteous about my views. So and, you know, it's kind of scary to think that if indeed I feel that I have everything figured out, that the whole entire world with us 7+ billion people, that I have all the answers is a pretty scary thought. So the antidote to that is to be able to examine new ideas with logic and intelligence without bias. So when somebody comes to you with a new idea in regards to doing something that you've done for years, the same way, is to look at it as an opportunity to learn something new and to look at it with a certain level of intelligence and clarity without making a judgment about what's coming at you as far as information. So if somebody's got a new idea, somebody has some new suggestions, is to see it as an opportunity to learn rather than somebody's getting in the way of you doing something that you are fine about doing for the past 30 years and you don't want to do it any differently. Open-mindedness also gives you the ability to disagree with an idea or a philosophy of someone without hating the person. Something I think that's going on in the world and goes on with my mind and I have to be very, very careful of is if I disagree strongly about a philosophical viewpoint or an ethical viewpoint about somebody, I immediately put them into a category of not quite good people because their opinions I find to be disagreeable. The opinions are different than the person. Our differences do not make us bad people. Just like our behavior does not make us bad people or good people. And that's something that we find here at the Abbey, is that because we're kind of the new folks that have come into Ponderay County, in a county that's been around for, you know, 60, 70 years. So people that live in this county have been here for 50, 60 years, and they've seen the county grow. They've depended on certain ways of living, certain ways of viewing things. And here come these new people with all of these new ideas. And so there's sort of this, the Abbey has really been trying to be skillful in how to interface its long-term goals, to share the values that it has in common with the old-timers around here without feeling like we're stepping on people's toes. And it's a really kind of a delicate dance, you know, to try to look for the things that we have in common with some of the old loggers and the old ranchers. But there are also certain things that they philosophically agree with and do, like, you know, hunting and dirt biking up and down hill and vale at, you know, 11 o'clock at night, that we don't particularly agree with, but we still don't see them as bad people. So being able to interface different philosophical views, different ways of thinking, and to be able to live as neighbors together without causing friction and disharmony. So, and I don't know whether folks have experienced that when you move into a new environment where you're the new kid on the block. There's always this little bit of adjustment period for the people who've been there, for the person who comes in. There's this kind of little bit of give and take and willing to be flexible. And open-mindedness also gives us, we don't have to defend our beliefs or our ideas. They aren't inherently ours. There's probably been another human being sometime in the time of the universe that's thought similar to us, had the same ideas, had the same feelings, have the same emotions. So they don't inherently belong to us. They're just thoughts that arise in our minds. And we get really attached to them, and we own them, and that's where we get into trouble. So being closed-minded and having strong views, we then have a propensity to maybe get a little prideful about where we stand. And so the definition of pride through the Dharma viewpoint is that we have a very, very strong concept of I, and in regards to people who are superior to us, we have a jealousy. To those of us who we consider to be our peers, there's a competitiveness in our mind. And for those of us that we see as inferior, there's sort of a condescending sort of feeling. So pride isn't just that arrogance. It's also, it's a flavor that runs in no matter where you see yourself in this structure that we create. People who know more, people who know the same of us, people who don't know or aren't as whatever, beautiful, talented, skillful, strong. And so one thing, we're spending all of our day comparing ourselves to others, which can be an extremely exhausting activity. We don't spend any time with ourselves. We're continually, once again, outwardly focused, outwardly looking. What are they doing? What am I in comparison to them? I don't like what they're doing. How can I get that good? We're continually comparing ourselves and not spending any time with just nurturing the things that we need to nurture inside ourselves. The pride arises a lot around insecurity. You know, because we don't spend a lot of our time really being good friends with ourselves, making good friends with ourselves, or continually, once again, looking outside ourselves for some sort of validation. We want to tell people all about our talents. We want to tell people all about our achievements, all of our strengths, our assets, our abilities, in hopes that by their feedback to us gives us some sort of validation of who we are and our place in the world. So there's this underlying insecurity that we don't trust our own knowledge of ourselves. We don't believe that the Buddha potential exists in each and every one of us to cultivate all the wonderful qualities and to eliminate all the unwholesome ones. We don't really believe that in ourselves fundamentally. So there's this insecurity that rides underneath our lives moment to moment, that we continue looking for outside reassurance that we're doing okay. But once again, if somebody doesn't say the right words and say the right thing, then the upset happens. And when you really, really think about it, I find that pride is one of those afflictions that's rather pathetic. It really has no redeeming qualities whatsoever. It puts us into such a state. It's the whole thing about looking outside ourselves for happiness. And And when we continually tell the world how good we are and how talented we are, we find that our circle of friends and colleagues seems to diminish exponentially. You know? And I know for, my own experience is that either from my side, when I'm flaunting my good qualities and skills, and I'm talking to somebody, they start looking around the room, you know, they start looking up in the ceiling, they start looking at their watch, you know, it's like, enough said. And that it also is that great quote, pride cometh before a fall. I don't know whether it's a Christian saying or an Amish saying or a Ben Franklin saying, but I think it holds true, is that pride comes before, you know, disappointment, discouragement, low self-esteem. I mean, there's no way that pride can really, really nourish the mind and the heart the way that we hope that it does, because it's completely unstable, it's foolish, it's unrealistic, because we're looking for an outside source once again to sustain the joy and the happy mind within ourselves. Pride is an incredible hindrance to learning anything, especially our spiritual path. Because if you're pride, you really feel that you've got it covered. It's got that closed-mindedness feeling to it. You know more than everybody, you're better, you're farther along the path. So it becomes, as does anger, a huge obstacle to any type of spiritual growth. Because you really have to have a beginner's mind through many, many, many lifetimes of spiritual growth, or you're just not going to attain what you're wishing. So humility is the key to any type of learning. And humility doesn't mean low self-esteem, doesn't mean low self-worth. It's just really to be open to whatever's available so that you can improve yourself and to really, really nourish the Buddha potential within you. And you're open to any suggestion. Not that you have to take them, but you're open. Pride creates a lot of negative karma. It lower rebirths are a good possibility. Or if you get another precious human life, you end up in a really impoverished situation. You don't have a lot of happiness. Your environment always seems to be not enough. There's really a sense of poverty because you've been flaunting yourself so much that you haven't really contributed to the well-being of others. So you get a rebirth where you don't have anything. You just sort of starved yourself by being proud. The antidotes to pride. All of our qualities, talents, skills have come due to the kindness of others. We have none of anything that we know, nothing that we have achieved, even our good looks come from the kindness of our parents, our friends, our teachers, strangers, even our enemies. So that's kind of a real sort of a humbling feeling to really think that all the things that we have, that we consider our talents and our strengths, come because of the help and the support and the teaching of others. It's good when we get a little bit too proud to remember our faults, to think about the things that are our shortcomings, take up a really, really difficult subject, open up one of Jeffrey Hopkins' books and start reading. Pick a difficult subject that you have absolutely no knowledge of, and that will be sort of a great reality check if you feel that you're, getting a little out of hand with pride. The other antidote, which I find this would be a fruitful meditation, is here we are wandering in samsara, being born, aging, getting sick, and dying over and over again. What's that to be proud of? We haven't figured it out yet, folks. We're still here. That's really a cause for humility, because we continually are cycling through samsara, going through this pain, this suffering. And there's no reason to be proud about that, because we're still here. Another antidote is to think of others' good qualities. So really turning your attention away from your own worth, your own talents and skills, and find somebody in your life, and sometimes I just list them. What are the qualities that I admire in somebody in my life? Or if it's not somebody in my life, somebody in the public eye, somebody I've known in my past. And that's really, really helpful. It kind of softens up the mind and really relaxes the mind a lot by looking at other people's qualities. And lastly, a really powerful antidote is prostration. You know, getting your nose on the ground, putting your nose down on the ground is a real good way to counteract prostration. Now, self-confidence is not pride. Self-confidence is that that feeling that you're very, very much aware of your talents, and that your response to understanding and being clear about your talents is that you really, really want to benefit people with them. I mean, your talents and skills are to be of benefit. They're to be given. They're to be extended. And so you end up having a really kind of a nice, humble, quiet, no big deal sort of way about you that people feel immediately calm with, feel really, really connected to. His Holiness has that. Mahatma Gandhi had that. He's an incredibly humble but self-confident man. And he changed the course of India just by the way he was in the world. But he really believed in what he was doing. Not in an ostentatious, arrogant, aggressive sort of way. But he basically walked his talk. And I think that's what self-confidence is. And humility is walking your talk. In a really, really honest, authentic way. Let's see. Self-confidence is self-acceptance. And a faith in knowing that we can become wiser and kinder people. It gives us a kind of a balance in our life. We respect others' qualities and talents. Which everybody's got some redeeming qualities. Even the people that you struggle with the most have got some redeeming qualities. Self-confidence brings a willingness to learn that we don't have all the answers. I mean, I love when His Holiness is sitting there in those Science of Mind conferences and he looks at the audience, he goes, I don't have any idea. You know, it's just like, and he really wants to know the answer. Can somebody give me the answer? Because I don't know what the answer to that question is. And when he says it so joyfully, and he says it so curiously, and he says it so, like, nonchalantly, that it just, he just opens himself up. And then, of course, people are more than willing to say, well, I can give you some ideas, or I know the answer. He's just so open. And that's self-confidence, and that's humility at the same time. And then lastly, of our disturbing emotions in this part of the book, is jealousy. Which, you know, of all of these, this is the one that's mine. One that's up at the top of the chart. And jealousy, the definition of it is to unable to bear the joy, the wealth, and the success, the reputation, and the talent of others. So anything virtuous that you see in others, it is so uncomfortable. It is so irritating. It is so unsettling to be in the presence of that person. And I've experienced this very directly in 3 months of Ajahn suffering for the first year here, is that it's an inability to bear the joy and the virtuous conduct of other people. And there's a part of you, although, you know, push comes to shove, it's a hard thing to admit that you'd really, really wish something would happen to them. I mean, you want to destroy. There's a harm that is wished on other people who you see as virtuous. And we want those qualities all to ourselves. We don't want them to have it. We want to have them ourselves. And jealousy runs in families, it runs in friends, political parties, nations, between races, between genders. There's just this. Oh, I mean, greed with envy is just, that's the way the flavor of the mind is. It's tight, it's irritated, it's hard, it's unhappy, it's closed down, it's lonely. Jealousy is a real lonely place. And you can't sleep, you can't eat, you can't concentrate. It's just, there's this ruminating. There's this stirring, there's this agitation, there's no peace in the mind when you're jealous. We can say or do things that can really, you know, harm another's well-being and happiness. Jealousy, usually manipulating, being dishonest, backstabbing, sneaky, are usually these side qualities of jealousy. So it's a miserable place, miserable place. And it arises due to the false conception that says that my happiness is the most important happiness in the universe, and that your happiness doesn't matter. Mine comes first. And if you're happy and I'm not, something's wrong with this picture. So once again, the I, you know, rears its ugly head and says, this is it. This is the most important I in the world. This is the one that gets all the focused attention. This is the one that deserves all the praise, the talent, the skills, the beauty, the strength. Your I is not important. This one is. And with that false conception, everything gets filtered through that with a jealous mind. The disadvantages, we can kind of already know those. Can't sleep, there's turmoil. All your good qualities get exhausted. Once again, there's no room in the heart to cultivate good qualities when the mind of jealousy is running amok. There's no place for goodness. There's no place for open-mindedness or kindness or rejoicing. Rejoicing is the antidote to jealousy. Rejoicing in other people's good qualities. Now, there's that saying in our Four Measurables, how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness and its causes. And here's somebody who's walked into your life that has happiness and its causes, and you haven't had to lift a finger. So if you're saying that prayer and you're jealous about somebody, then something, the intention and the sincerity of that wish is not there. Because this person is going to experience exactly what you've been aspiring for. Why are you jealous? So by seeing them in that happiness, knowing that they not only have that quality now, but then chances are they're going to share it with you, that you get to be the recipient of that happiness also, is a very, very strong antidote to jealousy. I'll just leave a few minutes for questions. And then the last chapter was a very, very short chapter called Catching the Thief. And this is, the thief is these disturbing emotions that arise in our minds that bring such suffering and discontent. And what Venerable uses in this chapter is she really suggests some quiet time at the end of the day to do a personal inventory, to sort of recapture the day, look at the places in which you were of benefit, places where you learned, places where you handled a situation that may have been difficult for you previously, but you really made a very concerted effort to do things differently. Then to look over the day and see where your struggles were, where the afflictive emotions arose, you know, to kind of see the situation, see the habituated tendency, see the patterns that keep arising. And by doing this at the end of the day, we get to really identify those afflictive emotions that do steal our happiness, that do steal our contentment, that do steal our wanting to benefit others. And that this becomes a crucial piece to integrating the Dharma teachings and to really sort of gain a level of self-understanding. Because the only way that we can really ever counteract the disturbing emotions is to really identify them. And they're going to be very, very different. Their strengths and their propensities are going to be different in each and every one of us. And it's really important that we get to identify and become very familiar with them so that we can start using the antidotes, start making the prayers, start creating the cause and the conditions to do things differently. So this catching the thief part of the day is to really use it to see the patterned reactions and to get a reality check on just your life. And you'll find that as you do that more and more, you become more familiar with the places where you are strong, the places where you need to work on, is that really things start to change in a very, very big way. And so that was the little chapter after these to give us a hand. So we have about 10 minutes, and I just wanted to open this up. If anybody's got any questions or any comments or any kind of anything for those who read.
Okay, so when I'm here, I'm really happy because everybody else is really happy, and then when I go to work or other places, I'm kind of like, oh, I don't want to be here either. How do you keep your little
One of the things that we have to realize is that even those moments of sunshine are going to come and go.
Right.
That's a reality check. That's very important. The other piece is that identifying, even though when you come to the Abbey, you really feel, you know, the safety, the happiness, you have to even realize that even here where it seems that it's really externally pouring at you from all sides, is that it's your mind that's creating the happiness.
Right.
Because you're really experiencing it in a particular way. And so when you go to work, the mind that still generates the happiness at the Abbey, you know, it's still, once again, it's now saying that its happiness is dependent upon the environment at work.
Right.
Okay, so the piece of that is to really understand and really own your own happiness and really come to terms and own your own level of how you make your mind unhappy. And that it is very, very difficult not to let other people's feelings influence. You know, I think some of us are really, really sensitive. We've got, you know, there's a little bit less in the front here, and people's feelings do influence us. It would be interesting to see if those situations that are difficult is to see others as wanting to be happy and not suffer, and that they're just kind of doing it in a confused, unwholesome way, and to use them more as objects of your patience and compassion rather than wanting them to be happy so you be happy, because you can't guarantee that that's going to happen from moment to moment. So maybe perhaps try on the object of compassion practice. See what happens, because they really are trying to be happy and really avoid suffering. They're just not having a very successful time at the moment, and that you could actually be somebody who could, you know, give them a hand. That's where you get to share your sunshine.
Sometimes when she's talking about like feeling one way, like if I do a meditation before work or something and I feel pretty good, you know, and then go to work and I'll find myself isolating myself, like just kind of being in my own world because I don't want to lose that, you know, like you're saying, just seeing the outside is totally being a victim to the outside environment, you know, like, oh, I can't go over there and talk to that person. They don't take me on a downer, you know, they always do. They didn't know what they're doing. I'm not so worried because I know they're just going to go down this road and it's just, you know, of self-pity and, oh, it's Uzo and I can't believe this happened. You'll never get the heck you need today. And I'm like, there's probably something bad. Right? You know, and just like, trying to like fence myself off so that I can hold my little world, and I just know that that's not healthy because it just doesn't feel healthy. Because I want to, you know, help other people feel good too, but it's like sometimes I'll just be like, I just want to stay in my world, so I'm just going to be over here, you know. And, I think, I guess it's just not wanting to hold on to it, it's okay, you know, just like, okay, you know.
Well, it's the other thing too is that we believe that that happiness is a little tiny piece of a pie. You know, that state of mind, that the mind that's happy and clear and really, really trusting of itself is a huge, vast, vast well. And it actually gets nourished by cherishing others. It gets sort of slivered down into a minute minutia piece if it becomes self-protective. So it's just a matter of you perhaps opening up your perspective a little bit to knowing that the cherishing of others actually feeds that limitless well that you've gotten a little glimpse of, rather than feeling that it's a little finite piece that needs to be protected at all costs. And that people that seem to be habitually depressed and be habitually complaining is that, I mean, they don't know where else to go. You know, and that by having the experience of having somebody like you in their life that can acknowledge that maybe the day has been a not so good day for them, but to continually remind them that there's something good. And it's something that either you know about themselves, you know, find a quality in them that you really, really admire, or one that you consider to be a positive quality, and continually bring that up. You know, difficult days, but they seem to be handling it really, really well.
Okay.
And I know that you've had this happen before, but you seem to be handling it much better this time. That's really great. You know, really kind of get them to stand outside of that a little bit.
When I look at it, it's like those conversations with this one person, it's kind of like a duel, like a mind duel. Like they say, oh, this horrible thing happened. I say, but I'm like a good pirate. And they say, but, like a good pirate. And I say, but, look at that good pirate. And they say, and just back and forth, and it's kind of like, even sometimes I just go, oh my God, and then a voice. And others, like right when you're saying that, it made me think, like, what, you know, that is such a good exercise. Because it's just like, it's, I have that certain things happen in my life where I go, okay, look at this good, you know, look what I learned. But, you know, I got to meet this person or something, but he just keeps, like, throwing it out there when I come up this way. It's almost brutal sometimes because it's predictable, but I just need to look at it a different way.
And there may be some time where you actually can actually show that, you know, in kind of a playful sort of way. Say, you notice that when we get together, we sort of do this little dance.
Yeah.
You know, because I think some people honestly don't really get to the depth of which they do. Our patterns are so blind to ourselves that I think a lot of the times we're unconscious of to the depth of the and the level in which we the pattern. You know, so he may not even be aware. Kind of feel it out. But you have plenty. It gives you an opportunity too to just keep, you know, bringing up the joy, bringing up the joy, bringing up the joy. So let's we've got about 5 minutes. Let's do what Venerable calls a little digestive meditation. Think about maybe something that was said during this hour that maybe hit home, or maybe something you'd like to spend a little bit more time thinking about. Something you maybe never heard before, or something that might have pushed a button or two.